You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, December 16th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live. Just steps away from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal. No longer in the literal, certainly never having been in the metaphorical shadow of the New York Times. We're in the heartland of America, Brooklyn, USA.
USA.
On the program today, Muhammad Khan, senior policy associate at the Washington Park Project, on the corruption in education, head funds, the takeover of schools. We spoke about New Orleans last week, the charter movement there. Now we focus our attention on New York. One red state, one blue state, same problem. Also on the program today, Taliban in Pakistan, horrible attack on a school, killing over 140, mostly children. In this country, the National Labor Relations Board has a couple of rulings that will help unions organize. And the heartwarming story of how Ted Cruz made it possible for us to have a Surgeon General and perhaps 23 other judges and executive nominees confirmed. All that and more on today's program. Folks, as you know, it is now mid-December of 2014, and we are barreling along, headed towards the end of 2014. As such, we require from you a little bit of help on some of the best ofs. We get a lot of email. That's why I put the New York Times metaphor line back in. They're like, you know, we're from California. There's not that much of a difference between Brooklyn and the fashionable dollar lunch district in New York to us. So use the New York Times thing. And I thought, you know, that made some sense. We also got somebody wanted that clip of me talking to Isabel Gillies' son. They wanted that for the best of. We've gotten a lot of push for different right-wing phone calls, a lot of interviews. So, folks, if you have an opinion, just think back. Go onto the app and just scroll through the titles of the show. See if one sets off an alarm bell for you. We want some ideas about some best ofs. So send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. And put into the subject line, best ofs. And also, let me remind you of this. Even if you do not listen to the show on iTunes, every time you leave this program a review on iTunes, an angel gets their wings. And this is very important at this time of year because God needs a lot of angels to go and drop off presents. I don't know how it works.
That's not how it works.
Okay, but nevertheless, give us a good review on iTunes. That gets us up the charts, and it's very important at the year end when everybody's doing their best podcasts of 2014 compilations. They'll never put a political podcast on there, and if they do, it's got to be something like, I don't know, Slate's Gab Fest, because that is just perfectly mainstream. But nevertheless, if you go to iTunes, just give us a review. That's very helpful. Of course, you know all the other things. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Mohammed Khan, Senior Policy Associate at the Washington Park Project, on a report that he co-authored with Zephyr Teachout about the hedge fund takeover of our education system. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. I'd like to welcome to the program Mohammed Khan. He is the Senior Policy Associate with the Washington Park Project. Welcome to the program, Mohammed.
Thanks, Sam.
Mohammed, give me just briefly, what is the Washington Park Project?
Sure. So the Washington Park Project is kind of an organization that grew out of the Zephyr Teachout campaign for New York State Governor this past summer. It's kind of a project that she wants to initiate to have a public policy organization that's focused on some of the themes that came up during the campaign, so fighting legal corruption, challenging corporate power, and kind of developing a populist vision for New York.
And, you know, one of the things that last week we spoke to Christian Burris, who has written a very incredibly extensive book on what has happened to the New Orleans school system in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. And when you contrast that with New York State or compare it, or either way, there should be. It is fascinating to see that in many respects that we are seeing the same game plan. Of course, in New Orleans, it was about disaster sort of a shock doctrine treatment of the school system. But in this state, it is a little bit slightly more subtle. Let's start with the notion of why would Wall Street hedge funders be so interested in taking over essentially the education policy of New York State?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I listened to that. I interviewed Kristen Burris last week, and it was really interesting. And I think we did kind of see the same shock doctrine applied in New York in these state senate elections this past fall. So this group that we highlighted in the report, New Yorkers for a Balanced Albany, they kind of just came together like really quickly, 7 weeks before the election. They seeded this group with $4.5 million in capital. And then they spent that money very targeted in just a few state senate races across the state, kind of overwhelming these districts with, like tons of TV ads and mailers and outside spending that in a lot of cases was a lot bigger and eclipsed the spending that the campaigns themselves were doing. And as far as their, their actual motives, it's really hard to tell. And I think that's one of the things that's the most troubling about this is if you look at the ads that they put out, the ads don't mention anything about their actual policy positions. All they do is rely on this fear-mongering of, a liberal takeover of New York State spearheaded by Bill de Blasio. They don't mention anything about their agenda with charter schools. So we really have no way of knowing exactly what their motives are or what their policy ideas are for New York State, because that's something that they never disclose.
And how do we know, how do we know that their agenda is exclusively charter reform, or do we not know that? And charter reform, education reform, I put that in quotes because it's difficult to sort of accredit them with a real desire to reform education. I mean, I guess they do have a desire to reform it. It's just I don't think that we would like the shape that they want to form it into. So how do we know that even their education stuff is not just simply a Trojan horse for some other policies?
Right. I mean, there's no way of knowing that. We do know that they spent more money in the earlier part of the year on kind of a PR campaign for a charter school group. So that gives us some idea of what their policy vision is. But again, there's no way to tell because there hasn't been any sort of – they haven't been held accountable to have a public debate or even a public explanation of what exactly their vision for New York State is and what specifically their – vision for the New York State education system is.
All right. Well, so give us a sense. I mean, who is Families for Excellent Schools? That sounds like I don't know anybody who doesn't like Families or Excellent Schools. Sign me up. Who is that? And how much money did they have in 2014?
Sorry, is it Families for Excellent Schools?
Yes.
So that was a lobbying group that was put together in the beginning of the year. And again, it was done in a very opaque manner. They haven't really disclosed who their donors are or what money they spent on lobbying. But we do know that some of the people who are publicly associated with that campaign, like Paul Tudor Jones, Dan Loeb, these are the same people that contributed to this PAC, New Yorkers for Balanced Albany, which spent $4.5 million on the state senate races in New York.
And I noticed Dan Senor was in the Balanced Albany, and if I'm not mistaken, Dan Senor, and I think everybody will remember his name from back during the Iraq War days. But if I'm not mistaken, he's married to Campbell Brown, who has been very aggressive in this tenure teacher suit in New York State.
Mm-hmm. That's correct, yeah.
And so, okay, so we have these literally millions upon millions of dollars being funneled into the New York State elections in the final days and weeks before the elections. And so what is the agenda here? We know that Governor Cuomo came out and said something which was stunning to me about public schools. Tell us about the privatization agenda.
Sure. So the like you mentioned, Andrew Cuomo during most of his first term was pretty silent on the issue of charters. And then you saw the past couple of years a big attempt at lobbying. A lot of money poured into this campaign. Coffers from charter school supporters. And then you hear him making these comments just a few days before the election about, you know, breaking up the public monopoly of schools. And if you go to another governor, Jeb Bush of Florida, you'll see that he made almost exactly the same remarks back in, I believe it was March of this year. So you can kind of see how that those two agendas are like coinciding.
I want to belabor this point. The idea that public schools are monopolies is one of the most absurd constructions. I mean, it is so patently offensive. It is not. I mean, the idea that public schools are monopolies is absurd. There are other schools out there. The idea that we have an obligation to fund private schools in this state or this country is just absurd. But they use the trust busting language because that resonates. And of course, they say this in the final days of the campaign so that looking back on the campaign, they could say, I campaigned on this. So there's a mandate here. And so, I mean, talk about what that involves, lifting the caps on charters.
Right. So, yeah, like you said, I mean, 97% of students in New York State attend real public schools. And then there's only 3% of students that are in charter schools in New York State. Yeah, we see, it's completely disproportionate amount of attention paid from the public sector to lift the cap on charter schools, to do these co-locations. They had a big fight with Mayor de Blasio early in the year about that, which is, again, essentially public money subsidizing these schools who spent a few million dollars on ads to get their co-locations, but at the same time claim that they couldn't afford to pay rent for their own schools. So, I mean, again, it's hard to tell exactly what the vision of these group of billionaires is for the public school system because they haven't really told us about it. But I think a lot of it goes back to their ideology and kind of like a market-based vision for what schools should look like, right? So it's kind of boiling everything down to high-stakes testing, so you have like a single bottom line that you can use to measure performance instead of having a holistic approach to education with, you know, art, sports, music, counseling. You focus just on testing. And then also this, you know, belief that anything that's outsourced or privatized is going to be automatically better than anything done in the public sector. So trying to outsource teaching and testing to companies like Pearson or like online learning instead of classroom learning. I think their agenda revolves really around this ideology of privatization and favoring market-based approaches to public sector approaches.
And meanwhile, it is starving our public school system. New York State, according to your report, is the seventh from the bottom when it comes to educational equality. And that is largely, I would imagine, driven by the disparate wealth of different communities across New York State and the fact that these schools are funded by real estate taxes. So give us a sense of just how deep that divide is and where we stand in terms of the state fulfilling the obligation that the state constitutionally has to education in this state.
Right, so the state does have a constitutional obligation to provide free education for all children in the state. And the way that's been interpreted is to have kind of a minimum level of funding and availability of education for all students in the state. And currently the state is about $6 billion short on this constitutional obligation. And then, you know, that's, again, this constitutional obligation is just the minimum, right? It's a floor. It's not an ideal that we should be aspiring to is like the minimum, or sorry, the goal for how much funding and resources we should be giving for our public schools. This is actually a minimum, and we're $6 billion behind that. And you also see that New York State has the most segregated schools across the country. And a lot of that, you know, racially also ties into socioeconomically segregated schools, where we found a per-pupil funding gap of about $8,600 between the wealthiest and the poorest school districts in New York.
Well, I mean, when you talk about the state is $6 billion, with a B, dollars short on its constitutional obligations to public schools, what does that mean? So, in other words, there are X number of schools in New York State that the courts have found to meet the constitutional obligation of giving everyone a free education that has at a baseline of quality, that it would take $6 billion to bring those people who are below that baseline, those institutions that are below that baseline, up to essentially parity or the minimum, I guess.
Yeah, that's right.
Wow. And so what's being done? I mean, how long has the state been in arrears? Do we all just know that and then we just sort of walk around or and enjoy our day, or what happens?
So there are a number of lawsuits that are currently pending on the state level. In 2006, the State Court of Appeals ruled that New York was failing to meet this obligation, but the state has so far failed to comply with the 2007 agreement that came out of that case. But there's currently two lawsuits pending that are, one of them is scheduled to go on trial in January of next year. And there's a second lawsuit that recently overcame the state's motion to dismiss. So we are seeing some action in the courts to address this lack of funding.
Well, I mean, it'll be interesting to see how those courts rule, and what would the resolution be in the event that those courts rule in favor of actually funding our schools to the appropriate level. Anything we're leaving on the table, Muhammad?
So, I mean, going back to the idea of what the agenda of these folks that are funding this push for charter schools is, I think one thing that's really troubling is the way they kind of use this very blunt instrument of a state senate, a Republican state senate, to fulfill these ends. So if you take them at their word, and what they say is that, oh, they believe that education reform is necessary because they really care about the black and brown children of New York State and they want to better their lives. Well, if you look at the agenda of the Republican State Senate, both what they've done in the past 4 years and some of the statements that they've made in the past few weeks, you see that there's an incredibly divergent agenda between the Republican State Senate and anything that would be helpful for students of color. So, for instance, just a couple of weeks ago, after the Eric Garner ruling, State Senator Marty Golden said that the Republican majority would block any efforts on police reform at the state level. So again, you know, one way to really help low-income students and students of color is to end the school-to-prison pipeline, to end policing in our schools, which should be part of any comprehensive police reform. And that's not going to happen if we have a Republican state senate. You know, if you look at the DREAM Act, which was stopped by the Republican state senate in the last session and will likely be held up again, that's something that would help students of color, immigrant students around the state. That's also going to be something that's not going to happen as a result of this spending by these hedge funders.
And how did Andrew Cuomo do in his promise to really campaign hard to make sure the Democrats took over the Senate in New York State?
I mean, I think there's very little evidence that he did anything at all to help the New York State Senate Democrats.
Right, indeed. All right. Well, Muhammad Khan, a senior policy associate with the Washington Park Project. Where can people – do you guys have a website, or how can people get more information? We will link to that report.
Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
We will link to that report at majority.fm. But if there's other stuff that you're working on, how can we check that out?
So we'll be launching more formally in January of next year. This is just an issue that came up that was really important that we thought we should highlight immediately. But starting in January, you'll see a little more formal launch of the Washington Park Project.
All right, great. Well, we will keep our eyes open for it. Muhammad Khan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Great. Thanks, Watson.
All right, folks. So I want to get to what's taken place over the weekend in the Senate. I don't think, and there's going to be more and more talk like this, and particularly following the MoveOn.org petition or polling that they did last week. Do you want Elizabeth Warren to run? And I guess the answer was yes. I don't think Elizabeth Warren's going to run. If, let me qualify that. Assuming that what we know now is the case in a year from now, or what we think we know now is the case in a year from now, that Hillary Clinton is going to run for office on the Democratic ticket, I find it very unlikely that Elizabeth Warren would run. That being said, and not the least of which, because she has clearly shown that she can exert a tremendous amount of influence from the Senate. And now the other day, I guess apparently she was asked the question, are you running for, are you ever going to run for president? And she said, I'm not running for president. And she said it four times, and they made a big deal of this. I think it would be both ridiculous of her to be, I mean, she's being explicit, but to answer every single version of that question, will you ever run? Do you ever have any desire? When you wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning, you look yourself in the mirror, do you think I could be a president? I mean, those are silly questions to answer. Because one of the other things that's happening is that when everybody is clamoring about you running, and you've already said, I'm not going to run, it still gives you a tremendous amount of power, and she is wielding it. Now, I don't want to overstate how much power, but I can tell you that Democrats, both in the House and the Senate, were very surprised at the final vote counts on the Cromnibus. She was able to take this really, in many instances, reprehensible. I mean, not just, and we went over this last week, not just the huge bailout slash subsidy to some of the biggest banks in the country, but also the expansion of campaign funding that would go directly to parties. And then there's a whole myriad of other things that were bad in that bill. But she really rallied people to vote against it. And then what's fascinating to watch is here is Elizabeth Warren on the Senate. This is just a clip of her railing against Citibank in particular. Now, contemplate, Citibank, I think it was quite clear, was never going to contribute to Elizabeth Warren. But she is going after this bank in public. It's a very powerful bank in and outside of government. And it may just be rhetoric from your perspective, but it is extremely strong rhetoric. And it certainly motivated a lot of people to vote against this budget bill over this past weekend. Here's Elizabeth Warren.
Now, there's a lot of talk lately about how Dodd-Frank isn't perfect. There's a lot of talk coming from Citigroup about how Dodd-Frank isn't perfect. So let me say this to anyone who is listening at Citi. I agree with you. Dodd-Frank isn't perfect. It should have broken you into pieces. If this Congress is going to open...
There it is. Should have broken you into pieces. And she is talking, of course, about the rollback on Dodd-Frank that this Cromnibus was, that this language that had been inserted into the Cromnibus. I mean, but to get out there and say that, you know, really, to put this back on the table, we may not do it in the short term, but long term, we need to break up these banks. And from a political standpoint, this is, this resonates not just on the left, but it also has some resonance on the far right. There are members of the far right who are equally concerned about the power of the banks. Saw Sherrod Brown and David Vitter propose a bill to break up the banks. So this is good stuff. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see what is done by the establishment of the Democratic Party to push back on this. Because there has to be some concern amongst the Democrats right now, or at least the establishment ones, that she may be getting a little bit too powerful. And it's not like she's calling in favors. It's just that she's putting out there rhetoric that is compelling other members and boxing in other members, both the House and the Senate. It'd be interesting to follow. More on what's going on in the Senate, because I quite enjoyed this little dilemma that Ted Cruz has. The Senate has confirmed on a 51-43 vote as of last night. I guess it was last night. Dr. Vivek Murthy as the Surgeon General. He is the youngest U.S. Surgeon General in history and the first of Indian descent. His confirmation had been held up for months and months, if not almost years, because he had made comments in the past that gun violence was an important health concern in this country. Fairly obvious statement. And the NRA decided to score this vote. And that basically means that when it comes time for the NRA to put out their rating of you, which we know as a Republican senator is crucial to prove that you're one of the knuckle draggers to get elected. If you vote to confirm the Surgeon General, the NRA will hold it against you. And this was Murthy's first chance to get up in front of the Senate following the reform of the filibuster. The reform of the filibuster basically said you cannot stop a nominee from being confirmed if that nominee has at least 51 votes. Well, Murthy got 51-43 last night, and so he was confirmed. How did it come about that he was confirmed over the weekend, more or less, or at least his confirmation moved through the weekend? And that is because Ted Cruz, I mean, you understand that in the Senate, everything is so Byzantine. And Robert's Rules of Procedure, I don't know if they use Robert's Rules or their own or a variant of it from the Senate, but there was a real concern that Harry Reid could not keep all of the senators, particularly the ones who were leaving the Senate, staying in Washington through this week, as it would encroach on everybody's holiday vacation plans. Honestly. And to get nominations through, you need to, there's a whole series of procedures that have to take place with people in session. And it actually takes time. Much of it is sort of pro forma, but you can't dismiss it. You actually have to go through it. And every time you put a nomination or a motion to go forward, there needs to be a 30-minute window for everybody to vote and this and that. I mean, that's how things get slowed down. Well, Harry Reid was able to set up votes on 23 nominations of this week by using Saturday to set up the nominees. He would not have been able to do this. And these 23 nominations are a combination of judges and a combination of cabinet officials, or executive branch officials. Understand, this all goes away in January. The Senate is not going to confirm anything unless it's something that's particularly high profile and can make them look bad. So the reason why Harry Reid was able to set up these nominations from starting to be confirmed this week by getting hold of basically use of all day Saturday was because Mike Lee and Ted Cruz had blocked a deal to quickly sign off on the Cromnibus. It eventually passed on Saturday anyways. But they wanted to block the deal to vote on the Cromnibus on Monday. So it ended up getting voted on Saturday. Because I don't know, maybe Ted Cruz was trying to make a stink and say, like, you're going to have to stay here for the weekend. Well, so everybody stayed here for the weekend. And when everybody was here for the weekend, they voted on Cromnibus. And then the Senate was in session and Harry Reid was able to push through the next step of setting up a vote on these nominees. So Ted Cruz apparently is going to get some coal in his stocking from some of the other Republicans. And, of course, he doesn't care because along with that coal comes a very good shot at winning the 2016 presidential primary for Republicans. That's all I get asked now. Who's going to be the Republican nominee? Jeb Bush has announced, ladies and gentlemen, that he will now actively explore a 2016 presidential run. He has not been on a ballot in 12 years. I have decided to actively explore the possibility of running for president of the United States, he said on Facebook and Twitter just this very morning. In January, I also plan to establish a leadership PAC, which will help me facilitate conversations with citizens across the country to discuss the most critical challenges for facing our exceptional nation. The PAC's purpose will be to support leaders, ideas, and policies that will expand opportunity and prosperity for all Americans. That listening tour is going to be dubbed, Why Are You So Pro-Mexican Tour? Is it true that you have married a Mexican? Did she have her green card before you did so, sir? Yeah, he's in trouble. Because in addition to not being very bright, I don't think he's so politically attuned. I really don't. I think his political instrument has gotten a little rusty. I don't mean to be explicit.
What I'm going to enjoy the most about Jeb Bush running is all of the kind of out-of-touch elite types who think that he's a really, really powerful candidate. I mean, I've had conversations with people like this personally who they'll actually say, I bet you're scared about Jeb running. And I'm like, yeah.
He just set up some type of VC partnership that literally offshored their headquarters to avoid taxes. And that just seems like something you wouldn't do if you're running for president. So I'm not convinced that this isn't just like, look, him saying to himself, I can't do it in 4 years. I might as well get out there. There's, you know, here's the thing. And maybe it was different back in the day, but there does not seem to be a downside to run for president and lose. Maybe there is on the left a little bit because you tend to get dispensed of rather than sort of create some type of cottage industry for yourself. Now, Jeb's not one of these guys who's going to be living off an email list that he has, you know, selling, I don't know, implicit racist musings for years to come.
Or fraudulent investment advice.
Right. But I mean, look, he's not going to have any price to pay, because when he loses in the primary, everybody who would have looked to him to win is going to say, this just confirms these are the nut jobs, right? Now, maybe he's in there and to be specifically a spoiler in some situations. Maybe someone's calculated like, hey, maybe this is the way that you keep South Carolina out of Ted Cruz's hands. You know, that's the way that who's that old guy who was on TV who was on the cop show? Fred Thompson. Fred Thompson ran specifically as a basically a stalking horse. Like, we're going to help McCain in certain areas. And that was it. And I think very much that's what Jeb Bush is up to. And look, it is a paid-for trip across the country. He's not going to campaign super hard. He's probably also going to develop a couple of business relationships. I mean, frankly, folks, who wouldn't want to do this? I mean, you get out there, it's going to be fun, it's going to be limited, you're going to make some money maybe, or you're going to build some relationships, it's going to raise your profile. Of course, you know, I don't think he's going to, I don't know how serious he's going to take it. I think he's going to do a favor for maybe who it is. Maybe it's Mitt Romney. Maybe it's a stock. Maybe there's somebody they want to make sure doesn't win, like a Ted Cruz.
Who do you think wins?
Well, I think Scott Walker. Right now, yeah. If I had to bet, I would say Scott Walker.
That's what I think. I think he cross-checks enough boxes.
He gets enough boxes because he's crazy enough for the base, but he comes off as mild-mannered enough for the other 15% of the Republican Party who will come out to vote. You got a very wide base in the Republican Party, not wide in terms of inclusive. Maybe it's very narrow, but it's deep. No. All right. We're going to take a break, head into the fun half of the program. I am contemplating, I'll tell you, you know, as we head towards the new year, one of the things I am contemplating over the over New Year's is perhaps cutting down on how many free shows we do a week. I'm not sure. I've had a lot of people say to me, you put out too much free content and it's problematic. Now, I do that for a number of reasons. But we might do that. We may go to like just teaser only shows a couple of times a week. We'll see. But it's a good reason for you to become a member of the Majority Report. Your membership supports this program, will help us help it grow. It's 30 cents. It's a pocket, not even a full pocketful of change every day. You pay tons for your whatever it is. Your cable, you got these other fees that you're not paying attention to. Become a Majority Report member today. Go to jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it from our link at majorityreportkickback.com. You will notice no difference. We get a kickback. And, of course, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. We will put up the other promotions we had this week or the past week from Bumbus and Harry's at our website at majority.fm. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number. Take your phone calls. Back in a minute. She's a
if I ask her to walk with me. She shakes her head at me. She's a pretty little doll who says no, 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 no. All the ask her to walk with me. Why can't she ever say
say no, 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 no. She'll say